Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Anchorage Hilton, where former federal intelligence officer John Cassara is speaking on terrorist financing, the war behind the war on terror. John Cassara was recorded on Friday, April 23rd, at a luncheon hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council.
I'm Rod Finkel, the president of the council, and I welcome you. I'd like now to introduce our head table, and to my far left is Will Tour. He is a member of the board, and we're glad that he could join us today, and he has been very generous in us in escorting our speaker around. Sitting next to him is Colonel Craig Perry, who is obviously in the U.S. Air Force, and he is going to introduce our guest speaker. Craig?
Good afternoon. Since September 11th, we've learned through hard experience how difficult it can be to combat terrorism through primarily military means. The success of our global war on terrorism depends first and foremost on the quality of our intelligence about how these terrorist networks operate, as well as determining what their key vulnerabilities are. Our guest speaker today, Mr. John Cassara, spent much of his 26-year career in federal service fighting terrorism in precisely this way. His unusual professional background, first as a clandestine operations officer in the U.S. intelligence community, and later a Treasury Department special agent, have given him unique insight into the nature of this threat. He is considered an expert in anti-money laundering and terrorist financing, and actually invented the concept of international trade transparency units as an innovative countermeasure in this field. Mr. Cassara wrote Hide and Seek, Intelligence, Law Enforcement, and the Stalled War on Terrorist Finances, which we do have for sale at the front desk. Our guest has lectured around the world to organizations as varied as the Council of Europe, the Gulf Cooperation Council, Interpol, and U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies. We are very pleased to have him here today to help us better understand the complex world of terrorist financing, the war behind the war on terrorism. Please join me in welcoming John Cassara to our podium.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hello again. My name is John Cassara. It is a pleasure to be here in Alaska. This is my 50th state. So when I got the invitation from the World Affairs Councils of America to come on up, I had to say yes, because you never know, this might be my very last opportunity to hit all the states. So that's why I'm here. I've also been in dozens and dozens and dozens of countries. I've never counted them up, but I'm sure the total's over 50. The only reason I'm mentioning all this is to tell you, although I've only been in Alaska for a couple of days here, this is a very, very special place, a very special land, as you all know. Don't take it for granted. It's absolutely beautiful. So, with that, thank you so much for being here. Because I think we have some very, very important things to talk about today in a relatively short period of time. Terror finance. Why is terror finance so important? Because if you think about it, without money, there's no terrorism. It's that simple. Okay? Without money, there is no terrorism. Now, we've done some pretty good things to combat terror and terror finance over the years. But there's a lot more that we can do. Most of my career was in the Intel Service, Central Intelligence Agency. A lot of it was in the Department of Treasury. And from a law enforcement perspective, we know that following the money is one of the things that we do that works, whether it's going after Al Capone back in the 1930s, whether it be tracking the drug kingpins, the Drug Enforcement Administration, whether it be going after Italian-American organized crime, the mafia, like I did with a large part of my career, whether it be corruption. In fact, the term following the money was actually coined during a corruption scandal in the United States, during our Watergate crisis. following the money works. So that's what we're going to talk about very, very quickly because we don't have a lot of time. I'm going to give you a 5-minute overview about money laundering. It's important because a lot of the countermeasures that we use to combat terror financing actually started years ago during the war on drugs. So we're going to talk a little about money laundering, then we're going to talk about terror finance, and I'm going to give you, there's lots of different ways you can finance terrorist finance or operations. I'm going to talk about maybe just one or two, just to give you a flavor for some of the challenges we have. So with that, I put my disclaimer up. I still do an awful lot of consulting for the federal government at a variety of levels. So everything you hear today, it's my personal views and experiences. It's not necessarily those of the U.S. government. So, money laundering. First of all, why do criminals do what they do? What is their motivation? Right? Outside of crimes of passion, it's greed. Criminals are motivated by greed. And after they accumulate a lot of money, they have to try to hide it or disguise it. So the government, criminal investigators, can't follow it. And in fact, that's the definition of money laundering I use, the disguising the proceeds of any form of criminal activity. And the key word in that definition is actually any. The United States recognizes about 300 predicate offenses or specified unlawful activities to charge money laundering. It's not just drugs, like most people think. Narcotics equals money laundering. It's things like fraud and smuggling, high technology, child pornography, and yes, even terrorism is a predicate offense to charge money laundering. How much money laundering is out there? Nobody knows. But the International Monetary Fund estimates it's somewhere in the area of $2 to $3 trillion a year, which is higher than our U.S. federal budget every year. And further on, they estimate that's about evenly divided between the criminal components, those 300 predicate offenses, and tax evasion. The only reason I mention tax evasion is that's coming at you. There's a lot of movement right now in forums around the world to make tax evasion a predicate offense for money laundering. Now, intelligence, law enforcement recognize three separate phases or stages of money laundering. The first one is placement. After you accumulate a lot of money, drug money, the criminals have a logistics problem. For example, this is the largest cash seizure in history. This took place in Mexico a few years ago. Round numbers, approximately $100 billion of drug proceeds is generated every year in the United States. That translates to 20 million pounds of currency. That's a tremendous logistics problem. So the criminals have to somehow place that, deposit it, into financial institutions so they can spend that money. Because, remember, they're motivated by greed. Now, after they place it, right, they layer it. And the easiest way to do that is to send it from one bank to another, from one money service business to another, from one offshore to another. And every time they do that, it makes it very, very difficult for criminal investigators and intelligence services to follow that money trail. And then finally, they integrate it. They buy those fancy cars and boats and airplanes. They invest in the stock market. They invest in property. They invest in casinos. They buy banks. They do all different kinds of things. We know that they're most vulnerable at this placement stage. That's where we've had our best success. Now, long before the war on terror, we were engaged in another war. We don't talk about it as much anymore, but it's the war on drugs. And about 1970, Congress started passing a series of laws, regulations, collectively known as the Bank Secrecy Act. Secrecy is a misnomer. It equates to financial transparency. So, for example, you go into a bank, you deposit or withdraw $10,000 or more of cash, the bank fills out a form. You cross the border of the United States, you have to fill out a form. The bank thinks you are engaged in suspicious activity, they fill out a form. You buy property, an expensive car, jewelry, and you pay cash over $10,000. They fill out a form. There are 18 million pieces of financial intelligence filed every year with the Department of Treasury. Most of them go to, or all of them go to, Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, where I worked for a number of years. And not only are we doing this domestically, countries around the world have followed our lead. We're doing it internationally as well. The Financial Action Task Force, put together by the Group of Seven a number of years ago, has come up with guidelines for countries to combat money laundering and later terrorism finance. But unfortunately, almost all of those recommendations, particularly during the 80s and 90s, were Western-centric. Now, why is all that important? There's a great quote here by Osama bin Laden. He was identified, located up in the mountains of Afghanistan about October 2001, shortly before coalition forces went in. And he was identified by a Pakistani journalist working for Dawn magazine. And they asked bin Laden a couple of questions. One question about finances, and aren't you afraid, Mr. bin Laden, that the West is going to identify, seize and freeze your assets, like we did with some success after the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. According to bin Laden, he said, no, we're not concerned. Al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups are filled with modern, educated young people who are aware of the cracks in the Western financial system as they are in the lines of their own hands. These are the very flaws which is becoming a noose for it. You know that expression? Friends in the military should know that. Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese military warrior of a few millennia ago, know your enemy. What he's saying is they know us, they know our vulnerabilities. There wasn't one piece of financial intelligence out of those 18 million filed in the United States or countless million more filed by countries around the world, not one piece of financial intelligence filed on any of those 19 hijackers. Nobody knows for certain how much 9/11 cost. They estimated somewhere between $300,000 and $500,000. Not a lot of money. You can see from the illustration that a lot of this is done in cash and in ways that didn't trigger these financial transparency reporting requirements, right? They weren't designed for that. They were designed to track large amounts of dirty money sloshing around through Western financial institutions, not for things like terrorist attacks, where you can see from Bali to Baghdad, from Istanbul to London, these terrorist attacks don't cost a lot of money, okay? And it's done in such a way, again, as not to trigger these financial transparency reporting requirements. Why is this all important? Because for the years immediately after 9/11, our government was fixated on financial intelligence was going to be the cure-all for this type of thing. It didn't work. All right. I gave you the definition of money laundering, terror finance. Here's another definition. Is the act of providing financial support to terrorists or terrorist organizations to enable them to carry out terrorist acts? This is from the United Nations. To me, what's interesting about this definition is that the United Nations can define terror finance, but they can't define terrorism, right? Now, there's some differences here. The motivation for criminals involved with money laundering is greed. For terror finance, that's not necessarily so. You can say it's religion, you can say it's ideology, you can say whatever you want. But it's probably not greed. And the source of funds can be legal or illegal. Remember, bin Laden used a lot of his family fortune to finance his activities. Charities are misused. This is legitimate money. Charities are misused to finance terror. Now, this Financial Action Task Force that I mentioned briefly, according to them, there's three principal ways, very broad categories of laundering money. through financial networks, banks, through bulk cash smuggling, like that picture I showed you with Mexico, and trade. And this is something I spent a lot of my career in. Trade has a lot to do with underground finance that criminals and, yes, even terrorists exploit. Value transfer via trade is very common around the world, but very little understood. Let me give you some quick examples of what I mean. Say, for example, somebody wants to export cargo with a value of $100,000. That happens a lot here in Anchorage. However, there are a lot of fraudsters out there, and they will falsify invoices, bills of lading, export documents to show a value of, say, $200,000. So $200,000 is sent in payment, which includes the laundered $100,000. Okay? Very simple. Remember, you're trying to launder money. You have to justify the sending of money abroad. Well, they just did that here through trade goods. You can do the same thing in reverse, which is what we call under-invoicing. Basically, you're settling a debt with a friend or a partner. Say, for example, Bruno owes Yehuda $200,000 as part of a previous business transaction. So he decides to pay his debt by under-invoicing a shipment of goods. So he sends $500,000 worth of goods, but only invoices Yehuda for $300,000. So the extra value of the goods covers the original debt. Now, there are lots of different case studies I could give you talking about trade-based money laundering and terror finance. Here's one. There were some wealthy donors from the Middle East, and they were supporting madrasas, religious schools in Pakistan. So they had to justify this large transfer of funds. So they had a side business, this madrasa, this religious school, this Islamic extremist religious school. They claimed to sell a large amount of animal hides at grossly inflated prices. Payment was made, and the madrasas passed the profits to the jihadists. Now, I put this up to give you an idea of the kinds of things that I'm talking about, also to get a few chuckles. These are real examples of imports and exports going into and out of the commerce of the United States. For example, do you know that we're importing plastic buckets from the Czech Republic at $972 a bucket? That we are importing briefs and panties from Hungary at $739 a dozen? Or cotton dish towels from Pakistan at $153 a dish towel, toilet tissue from China at over $4,000 a kilogram, and that we are exporting cows to Mexico at about $20 a cow, missile launchers to Israel at $52, and prefabricated buildings to Trinidad for a little over a dollar. You remember what I told you about over and under invoicing? Do you think perhaps that could be involved with customs fraud, money laundering, or as you'll see in a minute, the back door to underground finance? In fact, academics have argued that this right here is the biggest and most important money laundering methodology in the United States. But I'm here to tell you that we are not systematically examining it. If you understand this, you understand what it is I'm talking about. I can launder money with any type of commodity, from gold to a container full of apples to Alaskan oil. But look at this right here. This kind of dark purple color right here comes from U.S. shippers' export declarations. This horizontal line here is time. The vertical line is value. If we are exporting refrigerators, right? I'm exporting 1,000 refrigerators. When it leaves the United States, you should have 1,000 refrigerators at, say, $500 each. When it arrives in the receiving country, say, for example, this is Colombia, you should still have 1,000 refrigerators at roughly $500 each with some recognized variables. But that's not happening here. We're comparing our record of exports with the corresponding country's record of imports. It should match, but it's not. This, ladies and gentlemen, the difference between the peaks and the valleys is the transfer of value in the form of trade goods, in the form of, for example, refrigerators. And only right here, when we matched our data with, say, for example, the Colombians' data, did we put that particular money laundering conspiracy out of existence. This kind of thing happens all around the world, in the United States, in the Middle East, in Europe, everywhere. In fact, under-invoicing settles debts between traders. Over-invoicing allows money to be sent abroad. I was talking to somebody in Dubai a number of years ago and talking to him about money laundering and trade fraud and over- and under-invoicing. And he says to me, "But Mr. John, money laundering, but that's what we do." Precisely. This is what they do. The brokers, the traders, the freight forwarders in places like the Middle East, South Asia, they're adept at the art of the deal. And all this allows value transfer. And it's something that we're just starting to catch up to. There's a lot of underground financial systems around the world. And in these underground financial systems, trade is a common denominator. One particular system that concerns us, I was following this long before 9/11, but after 9/11, there was a lot of prominence. It's called Hawala. Anybody here ever heard of Hawala? A couple of you? I'll give you a quick story. Hawala can be very, very complex, but I'll give you a simple example of something you may or may not do. I do a lot of traveling. And say, for example, I go to Syria. I go to the Damascus, and I'm there on official business. And at the end of my visit, I want to bring back a souvenir for my wife, who puts up with my constant travels. Say, for example, it's Valentine's Day. And I want to buy her a nice gold bracelet because she loves gold. So I ask the embassy economics officer, "Where can I go to get a good deal on gold?" So he goes, "Go down to the souk, the market, and there's a guy there that we deal with. You're not going to get taken advantage of." So I go out there, and I see this beautiful bracelet, and I pick it out. Say it costs roughly $1,000. So I go to pay for this bracelet. And the guy behind the counter says, "Well, Mr. John, I don't want your money. I don't want your U.S. dollars. I don't want your Syrian pounds. I don't want your credit cards. I don't want your traveler's checks. I don't want your money. What I want is this. I have a daughter, and she's going to school in the United States, and I can't send her money. It's really hard here in Syria because the money's not convertible. So when you go back home, here's her name, here's her address. You send her a check. I'll tell her to expect it." I've never been burned by American once doing this. "Mr. John, I trust you." That, ladies and gentlemen, that simple, innocent example of something you may or may not do is kind of like a Hawala transaction because it has all the elements. It's safe, it's secure, it's based on family and tribal ties, no paper trail, culturally acceptable, and historically it's based on the gold trade. There was a definition that was used in California in trial years ago about a Hawala operation, illegal aliens being smuggled into and out of the country. The definition in court was money transfer without money movement, because in that particular instance, they used Hawala to send money, payment back home. Nothing wrong with Hawala per se, but it's misused by criminals and terrorists. So let me explain how this works. This particular example takes place in, say, Dubai and Afghanistan, but could easily just as much take place in San Francisco, New York, London. Doesn't make any difference. It's found almost around the world. You've got Ali. He's an immigrant laborer. He lives and works in Dubai, and he wants to send money home to help support Jafar, his father, who lives in Kandahar, who, as you all know from reading the news, listening to TV, poor security in Kandahar right now. He could go to a bank, but he doesn't trust banks. And there aren't any banks near Kandahar anyway. And banks will not deliver that money directly to Jafar's home. So he knows of a Hawaladar, somebody of the same extended family, tribe, clan. He feels very comfortable dealing with him. The Hawaladar is going to charge a very small commission, maybe 1%, 2%. It's secure, it's fast, it's reliable, and the Hawaladar will guarantee delivery to Jafar's home within 24 hours. A banker would never do that. And again, it avoids government scrutiny and taxation and those pesky financial transaction reporting requirements I was talking about. So Ali gives his Dubai Hawaladar some dirhams. He wants transfer to Jafar. Dirhams is a currency in the UAE. The Hawaladar may give Ali a code number that he sends to Jafar for the very first transaction. It's a recurring type of thing. Maybe a code number is not used. There's no identification. There's no paperwork. Remember, they know each other very, very well. So the Dubai Hawaladar contacts the Kandahar Hawaladar via phone, email, fax. And the dirham equivalent in dollars, or Afghanis, the local Afghan currency, is delivered directly to Jafar. Very simple, very easy, and totally off our radar screen. But people ask, well, how do Hawaladars balance the books? Because you got Hawaladars in New York and London and Karachi, or you have them between Dubai and Kandahar. How do they balance the books? How do they settle accounts? Somebody's running a deficit, somebody's running a surplus. The accounts aren't settled one to one. Over a period of time, at the end of the week, the month, the quarter, accounts are settled. Sometimes they use cash, like I was talking about. Sometimes they do use banks. Increasingly, they're using internet payment methods. But historically and culturally, particularly in the Middle East, in South Asia, they use trade, just like they described to you, particularly over and under invoicing, to provide countervaluation. How do Hawaladars profit? Lots of different ways. They also engage with currency speculation, black market dealings. They all have side businesses, and most of them either directly or indirectly are involved with trade. This illustration comes up from my book, Hide and Seek. Don't expect you to read all this. Just the fact that these transactions go multi-directional, whether it be between country and country or province to province, goes in both directions. Now, this is me in Afghanistan with a friend of mine, and if I can do this properly, I'm going to show you a very quick film clip. It's not happening, all right? I'm sorry. It doesn't work, but that's okay. I had a clip. I was in a Hawala market in downtown Kabul, and if the video had worked properly, I actually interviewed some of the Hawaladars, and I showed you some street scenes in the market, Chicken Street in downtown Kabul, of how these Hawala operations work. The point I'm trying to make here, again, is this is the kind of system that our adversaries use, not only in the Middle East and Afghanistan, but it's also found here in the United States as well. I once had a conversation with a Pakistani involved with this underworld of finance. And he said, Mr. John, he says, don't you know that the terrorists are moving money and value right under your noses? But the West doesn't see it. Your enemies are laughing at you. He's absolutely right. They're moving money and value right under our noses, but we're kind of looking in the wrong places. We're fixated on ways we move money here in the West through banks, with credit cards, with checks, with ATM machines. Many areas of the world, it doesn't happen that way. We have to learn about our adversaries and the way they do business. For example, in Afghanistan, you've got a lot of drugs going out Afghanistan, largest producer of opium in the world, which is refined to heroin, produce about 90% of the world's heroin. All those drugs are going out, and we know that the proceeds from those narcotics help fuels the Taliban. How does payment come back in? Some of it comes in the form of cash. Some of it comes in through bank transfers. Most of it comes in through trade goods, but we're not looking in that direction. Now, there are plenty other finance methods of concerns out there, and I just had a chance to go over just a few. Obviously, I mentioned at the outset the misuse of charities. Yes, for example, Saudi Arabia has been involved over the years with the misuse of their charities, sending massive amounts of monies to places they shouldn't go. But if we're talking about the misuse of charities, we also have to talk about the misuse of charities in this country. Do you realize that there are approximately 1 million charities and nonprofits in the United States, and they control about $3 trillion worth of assets? And then we have just maybe 200 or 300 IRS people devoted to this? You think there's some fraud going on there? Local crime, barter trade. You know that the going rate for a kilo of heroin in areas of Pakistan, Afghanistan, is a color television set. It is a commodity for a commodity exchange. I was told drug lords in Afghanistan, they want to import luxury SUVs, right? They trade the drugs they controlled for those SUVs they want. In South Africa, the criminal organizations are involved with the sale of mandrax, for example. Mandrax synthetic drugs coming in, there's a demand for that. They trade diamonds they produce for the mandrax, or abalone. Goes back to the Chinese suppliers. All this stuff is off of our radar screen. Where are the financial transparency reporting requirements for that kind of thing? Growing threat of mobile payments. You know, there are approximately 1 billion bank accounts in the world and approximately 3 billion cell phones. And the technology exists. In fact, it's being used right now that if you go, for example, into the Philippines and you're bringing your family into a McDonald's and you want to order a Happy Meal, you don't have to pay cash. You just punch in a few numbers on your phone and you pay for your Happy Meal. Well, it's happening in ways and in places that give us cause for concern. The technology is moving so fast that you would think that law enforcement and the regulators and industry would be talking to each other. It's not happening. Gold, diamonds, precious gems. Anybody here ever been to a souk in the Middle East? You've seen something like that? This guy is Saudi. At a Saudi wedding, a bride will wear kilos of gold on her person. Kilos of gold. That's what most of that stuff is in the back there. All these necklaces and bangles and all this kind of stuff. Saudis have the largest per capita expenditure on gold of any country in the world. Now, there are other countries out there such as India or China, even in places in Latin America where gold is an intrinsic part of the culture. But why is this important? Well, Osama bin Laden is Saudi, Yemeni Saudi. Why is that important? Well, you know, we have a huge reward on the head of Osama bin Laden. I think it's up in the tens of millions of dollars right now. Not too many years ago, Osama bin Laden returned the favor. He put a reward on coalition commanders' heads, and the reward was in gold. You remember the Danish cartoonists, those blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, right? The Taliban heard about that. They put a reward on the cartoonists' heads. The reward was in gold. Why gold? Because it's something that the regional audience relates to. Whether you're talking to Iraqis or Iranians or Pakistanis or Somalis, gold they relate to. It's part of their culture, the way they do business. You know, when I was in Treasury right around 9/11 and I tried to get us to think about gold, I was given a gag order. wasn't allowed to talk about it. We have to start thinking the way they think, not the way we think. So, have our efforts been effective? Very difficult to come up with metrics, as the government says. Measurables. Those are some of the buzzwords in Washington, D.C. right now. But one of the metrics that is popular in Washington is asset seizure and forfeiture, dealing with terrorist assets. So if you look at the numbers, and there are a lot of conflicting numbers, at the end of 2001, 112 million in terrorist assets were blocked worldwide. Key word there is blocked. Blocked. Not forfeited. Blocked. A lot of that money actually goes back because we can't prove it, so we give it back. But that money was called fruit of the low-hanging tree. It's a legal term. Or easy pickings. We knew where it was, so we went and picked it. We got it. But by 2006, 5 years later, that number only went up about 48 million. And again, that's frozen. Yet in 2008, Treasury comes and changes the numbers. Now they're saying only 22 million has been seized in the United States. 22 million. Not forfeited, but seized. Remember that picture I showed you at the outset of that huge cash seizure in Mexico? That's only one-tenth of the largest cash seizure in history. Gives us pause for concern. We've had, in my opinion, kind of a misplaced emphasis on rules and regulations, measurables and meaningless metrics. There, in fact, has been a paucity, a shortage of successful investigations and prosecutions and terror financing in this country and in countries around the world. And there have been things published by the U.S. Department of State that buttresses these remarks. In my opinion, we have to start fighting smarter, think like our adversaries, and get back to the basics of enforcement. So, with that, are there any questions?
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with former Federal Intelligence Officer John Cassara. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled Terrorist Financing, the War Behind the War on Terror, recorded on April 23rd in Anchorage.
Our oil is the same way. We're paying big bucks for oil that are coming from over there, and we're financing the war against us.
I agree.
Why isn't money transported easier by plane or overseas instead of going through banks and all the hassle and things like that?
Money is sent in a wide variety of ways, and obviously most money is sent overseas via banks, wire transfers. The number is astronomical how much is sent every day. But again, criminals, terrorists diversify. They will use a variety of different ways to get money across the border. I was in Jordan not too long ago doing some training, and they gave me an interesting example. They have a lot of Bedouins in Jordan that have a lot of camels. So they're trying to get the money, say, from Jordan across the border into Iraq. So what the Bedouins do is they get a camel, they put a slit in the hump of the camel, they insert contraband or cash, and let the camel go. Camels have a very strong homing instinct. The camel goes right across the border to Iraq, and we can't follow the money. So there's lots of different things that they do, only limited by their imagination.
You showed us that picture of the man with all the gold bangles and stuff in the
right.
back. How is that available to them? Is it real gold and stuff, or do they have to buy it from other countries or places like that?
Oh, it's real gold. In fact, there's different quality of gold, but in the Middle East, it's generally much purer gold than it is here. You go into Walmart or someplace and buy gold, you're probably buying 12, 14 karat gold. That gold is, if it's Saudi gold, it's probably 22 karat gold. Indian gold is almost pure 24-karat gold. those things are worth tens and tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars. And as you all know, the price of the gold is really appreciated of late. There's a lot of wealth out there. There's a lot of money out there. And people use gold not only as a culturally acceptable medium of exchange, but kind of a hedge sometimes against inflation and sometimes as a proverbial device that is used to hold value. Instead of putting money under the mattress, you know, they'll buy up gold.
Can you mention some of the reasons that preclude successful investigations of following the money concept?
There are lots and lots of different reasons why. Part of it is because, again, it's taken us a long time. We're simply, in my opinion, we're just now making progress, learning about the ways that our adversaries operate. We don't have, for example, a lot of Arabic FBI agents. We don't have a lot of Gujarati speakers. We don't have a lot of Urdu speakers, Pashto speakers. We need to do a much better job of recruiting more ethnically diverse intelligence operatives, criminal investigators, to understand not only the language, but the culture and the way they do business.
How do you see this problem being solved internationally? Do you see any hope? Because it seems like it's become a worldwide issue.
This problem, first of all, greed is not going away. Greed is part of human nature. Again, it's one of the seven deadly sins. It's been a problem since the beginning. So that's always going to be with us. We have made some progress in promoting international cooperation, international financial transparency. One of the things that I pioneered right before I left the government was to try to promote what we call international trade transparency. For example, every country in the world has a customs service. Every country in the world keeps track of what goes in and what goes out. So it's a fairly easy matter for us to compare, like I did on the screen there, what is declared in one end and what is declared on the other end, and that the anomalies, could it be an indication of customs fraud or trade-based money laundering or perhaps even terror finance? These units that analyze this are called trade transparency units. There's about a dozen of them that exist today, but I hope more will be coming on.
This is related to the financing and all, but what about the tracking of weapons and munitions?
That's hard, and I used to do that for a living as well. I was involved with customs, legacy customs, for many years, tracking munitions list items, high technology that was diverted to places like Saddam Hussein's Iraq or Iran or the former Soviet bloc. From a criminal investigative standpoint, it's much easier to follow something like that, an item, because it's basically going to be shipped from country A to country B. Maybe it's diverted through country C, but you can follow that, and there are end-user certificates and other forms of documentation. We actually do a fairly good job at that, but tracing the intangibles like money and value, that's hard, very, very hard. And as I said, they're masters at layering, disguising it. And then you have questions of venue and jurisdiction. Very, very challenging.
As a former international trader, I was kind of shocked at your list of things that I have actually done. But aside from that, I haven't done anything huge. And additionally, as a private person in Anchorage, Alaska, what could we do aside from recognizing these issues?
Law enforcement depends on citizens, on citizens' vigilance, on citizens being aware of what goes on around them. And some of our best investigative leads come from tips that we receive from people that know the industry that they work in, that see something that just doesn't seem right, something that doesn't make any economic or market sense, that there is an establishment that shouldn't be in existence because their volume of commercial activity is so low, but nevertheless they seem to stay in business and actually apparently are generating lots of funds. The kinds of tips that we get in from people like that that say, hey, look into this, we make some of our best cases that way.
Do you think we will manage to, if we manage to fix this problem of recognizing the cultures and everything, will the whole laundering money and everything be solved?
No, unfortunately, we need to have a lot more cultural awareness. And again, I applaud the World Affairs Councils of America for doing things like this and to promoting, you know, dialogue and a lot of conversation, because that helps in the process. But money laundering is not going to go away. We might, if countries work together, which is very, very challenging, because some countries, they will nod their head and put a lot of cosmetic reforms out there, but their heart's not into it. They don't really believe it. They don't really care whether dirty money crosses their border or not. There's a lot of international corruption out there. So I'm not optimistic that we're ever going to solve the problem. But let me tell you a quick story. When I was in Italy working with the Italians, Italian Guardia di Finanza, the fiscal police, combating Italian-American organized crime, the name of our program was Primo Passo, which means first step. The Italians back in 1990 were taking those first baby steps to combat money laundering. Today, in my opinion, they're probably better than we are. So if countries are motivated and they want to do it, they have to start somewhere. And there are countries out there that are taking those primi passi, those first steps right now.
I would think that using the transfer of trade value as part of the illegal scheme would make things a lot more complicated for the criminals, because they've had to expand the web of people that are involved with the transaction. But apparently that's not enough of an inherent deterrent to prevent that from happening.
No, not really. I mean, yeah, they expand their network a little bit. But a lot of times, for example, one of the largest money laundering value transfer schemes in the world happens here in the Americas. It's the black market peso exchange, and I'm not going to get into the details of how it works, but it has a lot to do with exchanging drug dollars for goods, commodities, that are then sent down to places that produce the drugs like Colombia. What happens is the drug cartels, they sell their drug dollars that they control in the United States at a discount. You want my dollars? You want to launder my dollars? That's fine. You can have them, all right? And they sell those dollars at a discount. So those drug dealers, the cartels, are then out of the equation, right? They, in effect, paid somebody else, in this case black market dealers, to launder the money for them via trade transactions. So you're right in that the networks broaden a little bit, but they deal with people they trust that have proven themselves over time.
Kind of back on the subject of the gold, how are they managing to get that amount of gold? Like, do they have their own mines, or are they trading, or what?
Gold has fascinated me for a long time, and I have separate presentations on gold. Let me give you a couple of examples of interesting cases. Remember I told you the most difficult part of the money laundering equation for the criminals is the placement stage to get money into banks. So what happened a number of years ago in New York is that the criminals realize that all these financial transparency reporting requirements were working against them, depositing drug dollars in banks. So what they did is they went around to jewelry companies in the New York, Newark area, and they bought up massive amounts of gold. Gold. The necklaces and the bracelets and the earrings and all this stuff. And then they smelted it. And they put it in the form of nuts and bolts, machine parts, tools, spray painted it black, and put a layer of grease on it and shipped it out to Colombia, right? Totally under our radar screen. The only way we found out about it was because we had a human source. Again, I was in Jordan. Jordanian Customs told me a story, happened recently. Again, moving money, moving gold. They had a criminal organization that wanted to move value in the form of gold. So they smelted the gold, which was really the proceeds of crime, put it in the form of a license plate, spray painted it in green and white, the Jordanian license colors, put that license plate on the car, and just drove it across the border. Lots and lots of different ways you can transfer money via gold.
Do you think terrorism would go away or go down if we all had the same materials, so we wouldn't have to go to other countries to get something?
Right after 9/11, President Bush said words to the effect that the war on terrorism is, in effect, our generation's war. This is not going away anytime soon. I don't see it going away, not in the short term. Hopefully, you guys will see an end to this. I don't believe our generation will. This war, these battles are going to be with us for some time.
Thank you for speaking today. I think I may have a couple questions for you. One is, we all know that you can't fight any kind of fight with corruptions. You mentioned the customs of this country letting some goods go by. Mm-hmm. And the enemy always use those loopholes to get to you. You also spoke about the basics, getting back to basic enforcement and fighting smarter. What are some methods that you think this country should use different from what they are doing right now?
What are some of the recommendations?
Yes.
For fighting smarter and whatnot? I have the last chapter of my book, Hide and Seek. I have a number of recommendations. Everything from heightened financial transparency, trade transparency, but other types of reforms as well, including things like personnel reform in the federal government, holding agencies and personnel accountable for their actions and decisions, getting the military more involved on the front lines with identifying terror finance and value transfer. There's a whole list of things that we can do. Some, we're starting to take those first tentative steps, but bureaucracies, and believe me, I spent a career fighting the bureaucracies. Bureaucracies are resistant to change. They preserve their turf, they preserve the status quo, and they're not flexible and they are not imaginative, in my opinion.
My question was in regard to, I guess, the initial dirty money and how much of that is relative to counterfeit money, because I know that the Fed had just issued a new $100 bill, which is what you said a lot of that was the denomination or the denomination that they prefer. How much of that is part of the whole ring of operations, and also how much of that counterfeit money do you see affect? Because that affects our economy directly. That is what directly would lead to inflation and things of that sort. So.
Right. It's a good question. Counterfeit is a huge concern, not only in this country, but overseas. In fact, most of American counterfeit is produced overseas. Most people don't know this, but there are more U.S. dollars in circulation out of the United States than in the United States. The dollar is accepted almost anywhere in the world. However, U.S. counterfeit is a tremendous problem. And the United States Secret Service, an agency that I serve very proudly with for a number of years, is the primary enforcement agency for counterfeit. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head anymore. But yes, counterfeit is used. It is used in terror. And it is quite profitable for those involved with that. And yes, our adversaries do counterfeit dollars as a kind of warfare against us.
What do you believe is the most important legal tool in combating money laundering? And more importantly, what do you think ensures money laundering, the money that's seized, to remain seized? So,
the most important legal tool to combat money laundering is simply to enforce the law. We have plenty of laws on the books that empower us to do our job. The important thing is to have enough personnel and enough resources to go out there and allow us to enforce the laws. In my opinion, Congress likes to pass a lot of laws, regulations, because it makes them look good. But what they don't do is they give us the resources to enforce those laws and regulations. That's the biggest problem right now, in my opinion.
My question is this. I'm of the opinion that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Right.
Do you suppose it's possible to work towards preventing the start of this problem?
You're absolutely right, and we need to do a much better job of, instead of reacting to crises, to proactively anticipate some of these issues. But again, our government doesn't work that way. We react to immediate crises, and a lot of it has to do with the culture of the bureaucracies. A lot of it has to do with funding. A lot of it has to do with turf and other bureaucratic issues. But if we want to get ahead of the curve, we have to start thinking long-term and head off some of these problems before they get out of hand. And we don't do a very good job of that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with former Federal Intelligence Officer John Cassara. He spoke on terrorist financing, the war behind the war on terror, at a lunch hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council on Friday, April 23rd, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.